The gavels drop. The bills fly.
If you're a public school parent now, I mean, you have a choice, which I think is wonderful.
The House passes vouchers for all.
The state isn't even fully funding choices in our public schools that are successful and have a good track record.
Committees tighten the abortion timeline, loosen the standard for death penalty.
This bill is about victims' rights. Sadly, my family has seen how a jury can be misled into denying justice for the victims.
A city attorney who ran has resigned. North Miami Beach commissioners boycotting meetings are ordered back.
Pay tax, something has to be done.
We can't just hold the residents hostage.
Old pipes, new problems.
A lot of that pipe is now nearing the end of its useful life. So it's very fragile.
What's on tap for Keys residents' water supply? The big news of the week and the newsmakers live this week in South Florida.
Good Sunday morning. I'm Glenna Milberg. From Tallahassee to the Keys, we have got it covered for you today. And we start with some of the most high profile, aka controversial, bills advancing in the legislature this week, including one that opens school vouchers to all. During the Sundays of session, we are hosting your South Florida lawmakers to talk about it all. Today, two of the newest members of the House are already making their marks. State Representative Ashley Gant, Democrat from Miami, and State Representative Alina Garcia, Republican from Southwest Miami-Dade, both with us live this morning. Ladies, so good to see you.
Hi, good morning.
I know it's kind of strange to do this via Zoom. You just jump right in and talk whenever you see fit. That's how we roll here. So I want to do start out with the school voucher bill, universal vouchers. That was a number one priority for House Speaker Paul Renner. He was here talking about it. A number one opponents are most of the Democrats who fear the demise of public schools. So Ashley, since you are that Democrat, let me start with you. Why do you think that, and let me just say, it passed the House, the floor vote was this week, still has the Senate to go, but almost a foregone conclusion at this point with a Republican supermajority. Okay, so that said, Ashley, why do you see this as harmful to public schools?
Well, there's no accountability, and we see that in the language of the bill that parents who want to homeschool their children can get vouchers with no accountability.
Well, that I don't mean to interrupt you, but that actually changed as the bill went through the process. There is some more accountability attached to homeschoolers now. But that said, go ahead, please.
Okay, so there's still aspects of that isn't truly transparent. If you look at the regulation of public schools and public teaching, as far as certification, how the money is used, we have a book that's probably like this thick. But when you look at public money, taxpayer funds being sent to charter schools and private schools that have different and a lot less regulation, there is that lack of accountability. And then from my experience, I was a teacher in public schools in Mississippi and Miami. And a lot of times when you don't have those regulations for charter schools, parents will get sold a pipe dream and their child will go there. And then what will happen after all the FTE money is gone? They'll come back to public schools. And I was accountable for making sure that this student learned for that year, not knowing what tests they took, if they took any at those schools, where they started off when they started the school year. So for me and my position and a lot of the Democrats, we saw that bill needed to go a lot further in making sure that public schools did not bear the burden of having to educate these students when they come back from these schools where there's no guidelines or requirements for the type of reporting that public schools are held accountable to.
Understood. Alina, so take that if you would. Accountability, there is, as we know, some accountability measures for private and charter schools right now, but to Ashley's point, there is a real dearth in other cases. But you know, what opponents, Alina, were talking about is that this is a massive, not my words, but opponents' words that we've read, of massive transfer of wealth, of taxpayer money to private school operators. I wonder if you would address that.
Well, the accountability for the private schools, you know, if you don't want your child, if you think they're doing a bad job, you just take your children out and they go bankrupt. They won't be able to operate. So there's absolute accountability through the parents. I wish they would have had House Bill 1 when my kids were growing up, because I sent my kids to parochial school and I had no help and I was a single mom and I didn't meet the threshold to get any help. So this is great for the middle class. It is absolutely a wonderful bill. And this is not going to hurt the public education by any means, because public schools are going to be funded first. That's going to happen always first. And if there's enough money to go around, then everybody will be able to get the vouchers. But if there's not, then they'll be put on a waiting list, as it always happens. So I think this is a great thing. Competition is always good. It always makes us better. And empowering parents and students with customizable learning options will not only boost educational outcomes for individual students, but will create competition that raises the bar for schools across the state.
So I think that you bring up a really interesting word, competition. We actually talked about that with House Speaker Paul Renner. So the way this would work, I kind of headline this for people when we talk about this. It's almost $8,000 per student that Florida gives per student right now, the FEFP. And so in public schools, public school population gets almost $8,000 per student. And now that would be in a voucher of sorts that follows the student to whatever school, whichever school the family chooses. So Ashley, how the competition now that schools face to lure the children in, why wouldn't that make a more competitive playing field?
Let's talk about facts. So Florida is 45th in funding public schools, right? And so we keep hearing this this message of choice, choice, choice. It's not about not being about choice, because 85% of parents in the state of Florida choose to send their children to public schools. What we're saying is, if we want public schools to be competitive, and it is truly about competition, then fully fund public schools. We've never been against parents having that option and having that choice. But when you're talking about taxpayer dollars going to charter and private schools, we do want to have some mechanisms of accountability. What happens to that money if they get kicked out? And also, to the point of choice or competition, these institutions are not required to accept students into the school. So we talk about waiting lists and everything. What students are being put on those wait lists? What students are not being accepted to these schools when we talk about competition? So
you're talking about how public schools have accept everyone, mm-hmm. private schools may not. Let me stop there. We need to take a quick break. We're going to come back. We actually lost Alina Garcia's feed. We're going to reconnect with her, and we'll all come back and reconvene right after this break. Democrat Ashley Gant from Miami, State Rep Alina Garcia, Republican from Southwest Miami-Dade. I want to turn now to you. Both are serving your first term, so it's great to talk to someone just kind of thrust into the process, and what a session it is to be your first. So one of the abortion bill is how everyone knows it, passed its first committee meeting this week. It's actually called Parental Support Bill. There's plenty of money and programs for parental support, but indeed it shortens the limit on abortions available to 6 weeks instead of 15 weeks that was passed with a lot of controversy in last session. Alina Garcia, this one, unlike last session, this bill does have exceptions for victims of sex crimes, rape, incest. What is your take on the necessity of this bill, especially at a time nationally when there is so much scrutiny over abortion rights?
Well, Glenna, you know, somebody has to protect the unborn child, you know. Back in the day when Roe versus Wade passed, we didn't have birth control the way that we have it today. Most women have access to birth control, and it's not that abortion is going to be illegal. It's going to be up to 6 weeks, when we hear the heartbeat of the child, you know, we already know that it's a child because there's a heartbeat. I personally know that there's a child from the moment of conception, but and I am pro-life. I think it's a good bill. I think we need to start re-educating people. You know, abortion is not, it should be like only in cases of where the mother's life is at stake, or where there's, where the exceptions for, rape and incest.
Yeah, and I hear, this is such for many opponents of abortion outright, it's such a faith-based argument in opposition. I think a lot of the opposition is that at 6 weeks, many women just don't even know they're pregnant yet. Also, amniocentesis, when you know whether there is a fatal fetal defect, that can't happen until 16 weeks, which is well after the current ban as well. Ashley Gant, when you hear people who are adamant about saving lives, births, and the House bill sponsor actually said those words as well, what is the argument to that?
Well, first, I would say that the government should not be legislating what a person can do with their body. Everyone has sovereign control over their own body. And there's not one piece of legislation that tells a man what he can or cannot do with his body. So let's start there. Next, to your point, a lot of women don't find out that they're pregnant until after 6 weeks. And so what happens then? And what about the fact that Black women are 3 times more likely to die in childbirth? A lot of it because of institutionalized racism in the medical field, where Black women are not believed about our pain symptoms. And so you have a high rate of Black women dying during pregnancy and childbirth. And so when all of these factors are taken into account, we have to look at how detrimental this is going to be on family structures, on the economic impact, about women not being able to go into the workplace or having access to prenatal healthcare. If we're really going to talk about parental rights or parental support, how about we start with providing access to medical care, expanding Medicaid and Medicare in Florida? How about we talk about providing substantial prenatal care? And this is in tandem with legislation that is being proposed that says children can't learn about healthcare and sex education until sixth grade. So how are we saying that we want people to, or protect the life, but we want protect children to know about their body, to know, when it is appropriate or inappropriate to be touched by someone or not to be touched. And so all of these things have to be taken into account. Sorry.
So let me, you bring up a very interesting sort of basket of bills, and the bill you're talking about is 1069, which is actually redoing sex education, making it available much later in the school career. Alina Garcia, I say this not knowing whether you are up on specific bills, and if you're not, we totally respect that. So let's just talk about it from that framework. But 1069 is a bill that would essentially, until sixth grade, there is no sex education. So what do you think about that? I mean, if there is going to be more attention on personal responsibility and birth control and such, are the schools sort of responsible for making sure kids are taught that?
Well, I think parents are the ones that are responsible to teach their children about sex education. And I don't think that up to sixth grade, I don't think anybody's going to be having sex, before sixth grade. Hopefully, no? It's possible, but hopefully they should not be having sex before sixth grade. And, and also going back to the former bill that we were speaking about, the abortion bill, if you don't want to get pregnant, why don't you just go on birth control? That's a great option.
You don't have sex,
but if you don't want to get pregnant, go on birth control.
That's
a great option.
We've heard that argument. Let me just... I have a statistic here that might be interesting to throw in here to this conversation. So last session, when the 15-week ban was being discussed, is being discussed, The CDC stats showed that 96% of the abortions that were performed in Florida were well before 15 weeks. And that was one of the arguments used by proponents, is that this is not going to affect a lot of people. That does not hold true for a six-week limit. It's like 3 out of 4 are done in 6 weeks. But it stands to reason, if you look at the stats, that the people who are terminating pregnancies after that limit are the people who actually have issues, not careless sex issues, but issues with either the health of the baby or the mother. So I want to get your take on that.
That's why we have exemptions. We have exemptions.
Ashley, you want to answer that?
Yeah, I do. It's very easy to say, you know, people shouldn't be having, children shouldn't be having sex after sixth grade, right? What about the fact that children are preyed on by predators and should know about their body and should know what is correct touches or what is incorrect? As a former teacher, I take exception to that, because there are a lot of vulnerable children. What if they're in foster care? What if they don't have present parents? We can't just say, oh, parents have the responsibility. It would be nice if we lived in a society where parents were very engaged with their children, but that's not true for everyone. So as agents of our community, as representatives in Tallahassee, we have a duty and responsibility to make sure that children who are vulnerable, populations of people in our communities that are vulnerable, have a way to be educated. And so it's not simply about women being careless and not being on birth control. That is not the representative population of people who are just, you know, willy-nilly using abortion as birth control. And I might add that people don't use abortion as birth control. There are so many things that can be done on the preventative part of it. How about giving substantive sex education to learn about birth control? How about having jobs that really make it accessible for women and people who want to take birth control to be on birth control? How about reinforcing the use of condoms to men as well? And it's an all-around totality of the circumstances that we have to think about. It's not simply just, oh, get on birth control.
So let me just, I want to just say that in this bill, there is money and programming for at least some of the things that you were just talking about as well.
Correct.
I told you that this would go quickly, and I just want to say to you both, I so find it valuable, and I'm so grateful that we can have these real debates, although fast, on substantive issues, and just a small taste of what's going to go down on the House floors in Tallahassee. I hope you'll both be back. Thanks so much.
I would love to be
back.
Thanks
for having us.
All right, take care. All right, up next, lawmakers are looking to change the unanimous jury recommendations required for the death penalty in Florida. Among the testimony they heard, one Stoneman Douglas High parent, and he joins us live next. Cases in the state, possibly the nation, a Broward jury recommended a life sentence instead of death for the young mass murderer who killed 17 at Stoneman Douglas High. A lone holdout juror took away the unanimous recommendation required for the death penalty. A bill that passed a House committee this week would change that, lowering the standard to a majority, at least 8 of 12 jurors, to recommend death. Tony Montalto, Gina's dad, was there to urge lawmakers to make that change. And Tony is also founder of Stand with Parkland, that organization. He is here with us today. Tony, good to have you back.
Thank you.
So Stand with Parkland, your organization is an anti-violence and school safety organization, yet you stood in front of that committee. It sounded like not as head of the organization, but as Gina's dad. And you said to them, I am here as a victim. Explain.
Well, let me just be clear that Stand with Parkland is about school safety. My support of this bill is along with some of the other families, but we're doing it as individual families.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but to your point, I know, and actually one of the things I was going to ask you is that the group of 17 families is so diverse and with such different perspectives and politics, and that actually was one of the things I was hoping you would speak about.
Right. So many of us were in support of the death penalty. I'm not sure if everyone was. Many of us suffered through the trial and watched the sad mistaken justice that was handed out in the sentencing by the jury. I am a victim. My beautiful daughter, my forever 14-year-old Gina, had her life taken from her by a mass murderer. That has, you know, affected our family. And we feel that because of the jury's incorrect decision, that our families did not get justice, that the victims, my beautiful daughter, her 13 classmates and her three teachers, did not get the justice that they deserved. Because we saw one individual derail that process by somehow getting on the jury and not realizing that the shooter should have been put to death.
Have you heard from other families who do not agree with that?
I don't know of anyone, but I also don't want to speak for any other family but my own today.
Of course. So the bill that's going through committee right now in Tallahassee, our impression here was that the verdict in the Parkland case very much was the impetus for this bill. Is that something that you've seen?
I should hope so. Again, we saw a miscarriage of justice take place here in Broward County. We saw an activist juror somehow get on the jury and stop the whole justice system from working properly for our loved ones. We need to remember that this change, if it occurs through this bill, will not alleviate the burden on the prosecution to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt. They'll still have to prove that the aggravators exist to make this convicted individual eligible for the death penalty. You know, additionally, it will also keep in place all the automatic appeals and everything else that the perpetrator deserves to make sure that the process is fair. However, what we saw here in Parkland was a system that was not fair to the victims. What we saw was people consider mitigators and then, although they found all the aggravators, find a way to say that it's okay that someone who took 17 lives, someone who chose to pull a trigger 139 individual times, including when he pressed that weapon up against my daughter's chest and pulled the trigger, one of multiple times where she was shot, that person should be allowed to grow old, to grow up, to have a life. Gina, her classmates, and her teachers were denied that. And we feel that and certainly in our case, the victim or the perpetrator should have been punished to the fullest extent of the law. And we believe that other families deserve that right going forward. We can't change what happened to us, but one of the things we have done through our advocacy is try and make things better for others.
Yeah, we've heard more than a few times during the course of that trial that if there is a death penalty in Florida, that it was made for this case. We've heard that. And we've also heard from people who are just philosophically opposed to the death penalty at all in any case. And I wanted to bring up something that happened this week in Broward County. There was a man who was freed from prison after more than three decades that he had spent there because the state attorney's office found that he was wrongfully convicted. And the death penalty opponents point to situations like that and say, what happens if something like that would happen when someone has already received an irreversible consequence? What do you think?
Well, I can't really comment on that. I can only comment on victims, but I will say that technology has gotten better, and that's probably had something to do with exonerating this individual. We just need a fair system. And to have a fair system, we need that the perpetrators, the convicted murderers that are put up for death penalties, again, there's not a question of their guilt or innocence at that point. They've already been convicted. And then the heinous, atrocious, and cruel nature of their crime, among other things, is what makes them eligible for death. Not every murderer deserves a death penalty, but it's the cruel, atrocious, heinous, and other ones listed in the aggravators that are developed by the state courts. Those are the ones that need to be punished to the fullest extent of the law. In Florida, that's the death penalty. That is the justice, the fullest extent of the justice system that my family deserved.
I want to talk about one other bill in the short time we have together left. The we call it tort reform, and actually Representative Tom Fabricio, who is carrying that bill, was here with us talking about how this bill would make it a bit more difficult to sue insurance companies. Trying to manage frivolous litigation is the goal. And you had said that that would have made some real difficult issue for you and the other families in your court processes after after the murders. And I wonder if you would explain that. Why are you against this bill?
Sure. First of all, I'm not against the entire bill. I'm against one very specific provision of the bill. And that provision in the bill will allow on a civil trial jury form, when the apportionment of blame comes, to have the perpetrator of a crime listed as one of the people that should be blamed. A civil trial, such as we're going through, and ones in the future again, because this doesn't affect us, is about negligence of either the property owner, negligence of an entity that allowed a crime to happen. To put a perpetrator of a crime on that form will, somebody who acted purposefully, will change the complexion of that trial, will change the apportionment of blame for that, and could lead to some very bad outcomes and harm the citizens of Florida. I understand that they're trying to curb some other things, and I don't know enough about the law to really explain or talk about all those, but I can speak again, sadly, as a victim, that I know that I wouldn't want to have to sit in the courtroom for another minute during the civil trial with the perpetrator of the crime that destroyed my life.
Understood. Tony Montalto, you have become such a valuable voice for justice for all the wrong reasons, and we always, always are grateful for your time on this program.
Well, thank you for having me, and it's important to have these discussions, so
100%.
Thanks.
100%. Thank you. All right, next, a city attorney running from reporters, commissioners stopped in their tracks. What is happening in North Miami Beach? The view from a veteran and a forecast of changes to come. That is next. A bombshell twist to the drama at North Miami Beach City Hall. The city attorney resigned at the end of the week rather than face almost certain termination. Hans Ottenott ran, literally, the last commission meeting from City Hall rather than answer questions about his role in blocking city business. Two commissioners say he advised them, though not the other commissioners, to boycott meetings, preventing a quorum and any decisions, which actually included his termination. The drama started with a power shift in elections last fall. Commissioner Fortuna Smuckler was reelected, newly empowered, and has shown up to meetings. And we invited the commissioners who have not to join us, and they did not respond. Fortuna Smuckler did, and as she is here, right here with us today. Hi, Fortuna.
Hi, Glenna. Good afternoon.
So the new, now ex-city attorney seems to be the key to all of this drama involving the block on city business since last fall. And I wonder if you can give everyone who does not live in North Miami Beach sort of some clarity about that.
Okay, well, as you mentioned, we had an election in November, and the residents clearly stated that they wanted a change of direction. And I have to give a shout out to you because your coverage on that ridiculous over six-figure gift card giveaway promoting a commissioner who, by the way, lost, had a lot to do with one of the many reasons NMB woke up. So thank you for that. You know, our attorney was hiring outside counsel and filing litigation without the approval of the commission, and that's against our city charter. He was not responding to my request for opinions. He was giving advice to commissioners, but not to all seven of us. He was giving advice to the commissioners that wanted to allow him to keep his $65,000 a month job. He was walking, as you said, he was walking out of meetings. He he locked a cameraman and the newscaster, not allowing him to get out of City Hall.
I guess
and
the
then
question
ran.
The question is mm-hmm. why? What would be his motivation for doing all these things as the attorney of a city?
$65,000 a month
to keep his job.
Yes.
So since the election last fall, you all have not had a quorum. There have been no decisions made by the city at all. This coming Tuesday night, the commissioners who are no-shows are court-ordered to be there. You should have your first quorum, your first city business. The firing of the city attorney is now moot because he resigned. What will you be doing if you do get your first quorum on Tuesday night?
Getting back to business. We have on the agenda discussion of our city manager. Obviously, we have to hire an interim attorney, and we need to get back to business. We have developers, we have water issues, we have so much that we need to do that has not been done since October of 2022.
So the reason we have to bring up the issue of the North Miami Beach mayor's residency, because this is the issue that the attorney and the no-show commissioners want to rely upon to say, this is why we're not showing up. We question where the mayor lives, and we don't think it's in North Miami Beach. So just to recap for everybody, the city attorney did an unauthorized private investigation that came up with some questions, but no conclusions. Shop that as conclusive to the press, hoping the press would pick it up. Some did, some did not. They took it to court. It is in court right now. Do you have any concerns about where the mayor lives? Who is still the mayor, according to a judge's order, incidentally? But do you have any concerns about the mayor's residency?
Glenna, so right now, Mayor DeFilippo is our mayor. I do not know where he does or does not live. I don't know where the majority of my commissioners live or do not live. I know that what was done, all this filing and litigation was done without the approval of the commission. It is being funded by the city without the approval of our commission. And until I have an attorney in there that's gonna do what is the best thing for our city, whether it be to file to get rid of him or not to do anything, until I have a proper attorney telling me what to do, I don't know what I'm gonna do.
So for, you know, Miami-Dade and Broward have dozens of cities, and very rarely does anybody scrutinize a smaller city's finances or decisions, and maybe we should. That's on us. So I wonder if you could just talk a little bit big picture for all of the city governments that go on. How is it that a city attorney who works for the city can only operate by communicating with two or three instead of, in your case, all seven? I mean, how is that even possible?
It's not possible, Glenna. It was being done, and he was advising them not to come to the commission meetings. He was going rogue on us.
You couldn't terminate him because you didn't have a quorum.
Correct. And we are supposed to have a quorum now on Tuesday. I'm also obligated to go. It's not just the three missing. All seven of us have to show up. And of course, I was going to show up, but he resigned because he knew he was going to get fired.
So right now, everyone should know there are a couple of court cases in play. One is, as mentioned before, the question about where the mayor lives. The other is a question about one of the no-show commissioners, how many days he's actually missed, and whether or not by charter he's missed too many to keep his seat. So now, without a city attorney representing the city, do those court cases go forward? How does that work?
Well, we will be picking, and hopefully we will be picking an interim city attorney on Tuesday, and we will have to have discussion with him or her to decide if these cases have any standing, if it's part of the charter. Can we decide on whether the mayor lives or does not live as a commission? Can we decide on Commissioner Joseph's missing It's been 150 days that he's been out. All this will be decided with our new city attorney.
So I want to thank you for always being accessible, always answering our calls. Not everybody in government does, not just in North Miami Beach, but we find in a lot of other places, and it helps to keep the public informed and aware. And we will see you Tuesday night. Thanks so much for tuning in.
Yes, you will. Thank you, Glenna.
All right. And up next to the Florida Keys, as promised, where an underground water main break started the same flood of trouble as South Florida mainlanders know too well. Stay tuned. Water calamity in the Keys had nothing to do with the storm and everything to do with an issue that so many South Florida neighborhoods have in common. Underground pipes older than old, older than their own intended lifespan. The repairs upend traffic. Everyone in the Upper Keys is asked to cut back water use where they can. And if you remember the water main ruptures in Fort Lauderdale and Miami Beach, the very same issue of old corroding pipes is to blame. Greg Veliz is the executive director of the Florida Keys Aqueduct Authority here with us live right now. Greg, good to see you.
Good afternoon, Glenna. How are you?
I'm good. Did I pronounce your name right? Veliz?
Yes, you did.
All right. Good. Good guess. really appreciate you being with us because I know it's a very busy time for you. So let me start out with informing everyone, like real time, what is happening now? Is the break fixed? Is there construction going on? What's happening as we speak?
Well, there's a lot of things happening right now. Right now, we're trying to rebuild our stores. So when we're asking people to conserve water, that's the reason. We're trying to rebuild the storage tanks that we have throughout our system. We have repaired the leaks that occurred. There were three consecutive leaks within a three-day period. That was problematic. And what it did was deplete our stores because we try to backfeed out of those tanks in order to keep everybody in water, and by the third one, we were out. We also have a 5-mile replacement program going on right now, which we will be replacing 5 miles of our most susceptible pipe, but it's far short of where we need to go.
So that's a lot of answers to one question. So let me break some down because this is a Keys issue at the moment, but boy, everybody who lives in South Florida, especially in the older neighborhoods, this is for you, right? So this old water main, I mean, we showed video of it. It's old, it's corroded. It could go at any minute. And it did 3 times in a week for you, keeping you all scrambling. Water pressure down. I want to talk about the storage because what the Keys faces that not a lot of older mainland neighborhoods face is one way in and one way out. And so when you have to replace that main along US 1, what is that doing to the traffic situation?
Well, as the video showed throughout the week, it backs up traffic considerably depending on where the break occurs. Sometimes we're able to work on it out of the main traffic and being able to keep traffic flowing. But in most cases, where the pipe is situated, it creates a pretty big traffic jam, depending especially on the day.
All right, so you're talking about the Keys water comes from storage tanks through that water main. Where are the storage tanks? And how important is the water main, or is there a workaround while you fix the break?
Well, all of our water comes from Florida City. We also have 2 reverse osmosis plants here further south. A majority of it comes from Florida City, and it comes down a pipe 130 miles. We have storage tanks situated throughout that system. And depending on where the break is, we can continue to feed from Florida City, but everything south of that break will be fed from the storage tanks that are placed south of that particular break.
So in the Upper Keys right now, the breaks were in Isla Mirada and Tavernier, right? So the Upper Keys residents and visitors and businesses, are they conserving water right now? Are they well serviced at the moment?
We've turned down the pressures just a little bit so that we can build up our stores right now. You know, we're in the middle of season and spring break. So our demand is very, very high. We've reduced the amount of water that we're pumping out of Florida City from the 25, 26 million gallon a day average that we were running, and we've reduced it now to 22 million gallons a day. So in order to, since we have less water coming down, we had to reduce the pressures just a tad so we could start building up some of our reserves.
And that allows the schools that were closed to open, it allowed businesses that had to close. Is everything open now?
Everything should be open now, yes.
Okay, good. So, all right. So let's talk about, you mentioned a 5-mile replacement, and then you mentioned 130-mile pipe. So 5 miles is a very small fraction of that pipe. Am I doing the math right there?
The math is very, very right. Like, if we are starting now, I will not see the end of this project, but it's gonna extend out for a period of time. And I think it's important to talk about cost. The Florida Keys are very difficult to work in because of traffic, because of the placement of the pipe. You're looking at about $7 to $10 million a mile in replacing that. So not only is the work conditions challenging, the money and the funds to finance a project like that is also challenging.
$7 to $10 million a mile? Did I hear you right? $7 to $10 million a mile. And is that 5 miles fully funded yet?
It is.
And the rest of it is not?
People have been calling. We've been speaking to Tallahassee consecutively for many years. We've gotten some contacts this week from Congressman Jimenez, and he was very interested in helping out. So we're hoping that we can get, we're in design for another 7 miles, and that would take care of the most problematic area. We're hoping that we can get the funding for that and roll right into that after this 5.
Okay, so now that we've done math, let's do a little science. What about these pipes are corroding? I guess these are from the 60s. I was looking to something to compare. Older than bell bottoms, older than the Beatles. They're from the 60s. What's the difference between these, what looks like steel, metal, corrosion, with what is going in for $7 to $10 million a mile? What's the difference in the piping, if there is any difference?
Well, many, many years ago, the Florida Keys Aqueduct was sold on ductile iron pipes. They've not turned out to be as resistant to the elements down here as we had hoped. So we're going back to steel, and some of what we're using is a more, and not to have the scientific term, more of a plastic pipe that we put underneath the channels. As you know, we have 42 crossings, bridge crossings, and instead of strapping the pipe as we did before, that made them highly susceptible to storms and things, we're putting them underneath the water. So we've got to have a more flexible pipe to make that run.
So I feel like we've learned more about subterranean water pipes in the last 7 minutes than I've known in my lifetime. Is there anything else you want to tell on this Sunday afternoon, tell your Keys residents before we go? Now I'll give you the bully pulpit. What do they need to be doing?
Right now, just helping out by conservation. I want to thank everyone for being so patient with us. It was a tough week for everyone down here and for most of our visitors, but we are working on it. We're out there beating the bushes for funds all the time, trying to get more and more of this pipe replaced, and we will continue to make those efforts and continue to serve. Our stores are back up to an acceptable level now, where we think we could, if in fact we did have another break, we could backfeed. So we're feeling a lot more comfortable today than we did last week at this time.
Are you expecting another break? Are you actively looking for one?
I am not actively looking for one, no. But will there be another one? There's a better than average chance that we will suffer another break at some point. It's just being prepared to get it done. It's about a 12-hour window of time that it takes to fix a pipe, any type of break. So we've got to backfeed whoever's south of that break for a 12-hour period.
Greg Velez from the Florida Keys Aqueduct Authority, great to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be right back. Stay tuned.